Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 8th, 2003. Today's session is Whitewashing Moses and the Prophets, How the West Stole the Bible from Africa. Session 1 of Afro-Asiatic Roots of the Old Testament, presented by Peter Nash. The number is NAP2003-01. Let's listen in.
Burn it, Tom.
My name is Peter Nash. I'm a little confused, and that's sort of normal, but it's compounded this year because I've been out of the country for 8 years, and I came back last week, and I'm trying to find my way back into at least some parts of U.S. culture. And not fully willingly, as you'll perceive by some of the little throwaway comments that are bound to come up. We're going to talk this week about the Afro-Asiatic roots of the Old Testament, because it's something that gets partially done in most universities in the West, and partially done in our theological seminaries. And there's just a whole lot of inaccurate information that's being taught to your pastors. I don't care if they're Lutheran or Presbyterian or Methodist. Just a word of background about me. I was educated in a Presbyterian seminary, taught at a Methodist seminary, and I'm a Lutheran pastor. And so I know.
You are.
It doesn't matter where you go. Some of these things that should have been never been said or written or published are written and published and taught in seminaries of all denominations. In the U.S. and in Europe, in South America, and unfortunately, ironically, in Africa. Afro-Asiatic. What is this guy talking about? Anybody got a guess as to what I'm trying to say here with this?
Tiger Woods.
Tiger Woods. You're learning something every day.
Forgot the Native American.
Pardon?
Forgot the Native American. He's all three.
Is he?
Yeah.
This is one of the things I want to get to eventually. I got really good news and really bad news. If any of you have ever felt bad about being sort of white bread middle America, I got good news because you're all Afro-descendants. Right? Not one of you that doesn't have African roots. So, you know, come on, twist your hair. Learn the boogie. It's possible because it's in your blood. Current genetic theory, DNA theory, supports that, runs that direction. And so that's part of what we're going to do in this first session is sort of dismantle some of the stupidity that we've been propagating for the last, I listed at about 350 years. Other people take it back farther. Certainly we've always had divisions among people based on the way people look, based on the way people pray, based on the way people, the languages that people speak. But these have become naturalized so that we know that when we see a person with clear skin or fair skin and light hair and light eyes, we know something about them. We see someone with dark skin and curly hair or wild hair, perhaps. We know something about him or her. And this is something that the university has participated in. This is something that the seminary has participated in, something that the church very strongly, unfortunately, has participated in. And it's time for it to stop, as far as I'm concerned. Afro-Asiatic. Africa, Asia. This is Western Asia, Asia Minor, that I'm talking about. It's a language and culture. It's a continuum of languages, a continuum of cultures and languages that are spoken and lived, or were spoken and lived, from the foot of Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania, modern-day Tanzania, all the way up into Mesopotamia, Asia Minor. Unfortunately, it still doesn't look right to me. For a while, in the last century, it was called Hamito-Semitic. All of these, except for Afro-Asiatic, Hamito-Semitic comes from the Genesis 9 story, where Ham and Shem are sons of Noah at the period of the Great Flood, and immediately after the Great Flood in the Table of Nations in Genesis 10, where the world is populated and everybody gets named as one of the descendants of descendants of Ham, Sem, Shem, or Japheth. And then for a while it was called Cushito-Semitic. Note that Semites are pretty consistent here because most people in the West know some Semites or know about some Semites. The Semites, Semitic languages are Hebrew, which most of us know the Hebrew Bible. Hebrew and Aramaic, but the Hebrew Bible was written in. But it also includes Arabic. One of the great ironies of the conflicts of the 20th century in the Middle East is that the Arabs, Arabic-speaking peoples, for the most part, there are also Persians who are Muslims. Indo-European peoples, which is something that we forgot about during the great conflict with Iran back in the 1970s and 80s. That they are Indo-Europeans like us. I include myself because I was educated here and raised here. Akkadian, you may have heard it from the great city of Agade. Babylonian and Assyrian are Semitic languages. Phoenician and Punic are Semitic languages. And, of course, Syriac, an Aramaic dialect. Several Aramaic dialects are all Semitic languages. And it's a language family. That's a part of a larger language family. In the same way that we talk about the Indo-Germanic or the Indo-European languages, which include Greek and Latin, also include in the Indo-Germanic languages, especially German and English, the Nordic languages, so that in the same way that you can listen, if you don't listen really carefully or if you're not convincing yourself before the conversation starts, and you listen to a Dane or a Swede or a Norwegian or a German or even an Icelander talk, you're going to understand some of the things that they say. You know, if you're not listening really careful, somebody comes in and says, good morning, or good morning. Yeah? You're going to understand that they say good morning because the languages all come from the same family, come from the same linguistic, or the branches of the same or of the same linguistic tree. Another Indo-European family is the Romance language family, where we have French and Italian and Portuguese and Spanish and Romanish. I left one out, the Italian. And the same sort of thing. If you know one, you kind of get by in the other, at least reading and often speaking, if the conversation doesn't get too deep. They share something in language, and because of their proximity, they share some things in culture. On Thursday or Friday, I can't remember which day, we're going to look at some specific examples of biblical cultural phenomena that I think are related, that illustrate for us why it makes sense to talk about the biblical, the Old Testament world as an Afro-Asiatic world, rather than thinking of it as we often do, as a pre-Western world. Often we get into this rut of thinking back through the Testaments. One of the problems of reading the Old Testament through the New instead of reading the New Testament through the Old is that we kind of take some things from the Greco-Roman world that were imposed on the New Testament culture, which is a Semitic culture, or perhaps even an Afro-Asiatic culture. And regard them as normative when, in fact, I think they were quite jarring. We're going to talk about the Levirate law, which is listed up there on the sheet. You can see what that is. I can't remember if it's Thursday or Friday. I'm going to talk about that. Jim's been very good in the morning, minus that you might not choose to come back. So. On the Afro side, the Hamitic side, or the Cushitic side, is the Egyptian language, the ancient languages of Nubia / Ethiopia. The modern Ethiopic languages seem to be more Semitic than they are Cushitic If you know some Ethiopian refugees or immigrants, they probably speak Amharic, which is a Semitic language. So there's these broad language families and cultural continuums have have places in common, customs in common that make sense, that are contact points. It's all a long way of saying that linguistically and culturally, I think we need to start looking at the Old Testament not as our story, but as a story that is sort of jarring when we look at it. Because these folks not only didn't look like us, they didn't think like us, and in many cases they didn't act like us. And then we have to make some decisions about how much of it we can accept and why and where we accept what was going on back then. When you read your Old Testament, almost everybody in the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible lived out of an Afro-Asiatic culture. I don't care who you're talking about, unless it's the Persians, the Hittites, the Philistines, and later the Greeks. Everybody else is part of this Afro-Asiatic cultural continuum. Now, that's not the way I was taught. So it's, and that's not the way most of my colleagues teach. So it's important for me to say that with great regularity. Any questions so far? Anything that's not being said in a manner that you can understand it?
I guess the only question I would have is, when you say Asiatic, you said Asia Minor, so you're not, so Persia is the boundary point, as you're saying. It doesn't,
yeah.
There isn't anything that goes, so to speak, east of Persia.
Not that I'm aware of. There were cultural contacts, but in terms of a continuum of culture and language, mm-hmm. The languages, when you go, for example, Persia is Indo-European with its language roots coming out of India and going up over the Caucasus and then up into Europe. So this, let me see if I was about to draw a map and see if I can get at some of this some visually at this. But there were some contacts with the continent of Asia going way back into the at least into the middle of the second millennium before Christ. They're not regular contacts. It's not a cultural sharing. Starting in the Neolithics, which would be about 7,000 years before present, the trade routes from Asia Minor down into Africa and back are pretty well established by archaeology.
Yeah. We're not used to seeing these two words hyphenated, except in terms of cuisine these days. Now all kinds of food get mixed up all over the place. Are you going to describe what this cultural hybrid in most people's minds looks like? And is it something that's only ancient, or is it something that also exists today?
Yes, that's what I was trying to say. First question, yes. On Thursday, I'm going to show some specific examples. Throughout the week, I'm going to try to show some specific examples from the biblical text where I think they saw themselves. I think tomorrow I'm scheduled to talk about how the Israelite self-concept was much more African than we give credit for. You know, at least five of the tribes of Israel, for example, have genealogies that include Africans. So that not just there was an African there, but one of our great forebears was an African. And we don't talk about that in seminary. And then the other day, Thursday or Friday, I'll talk about the Levirate law and child nephew borrowing to extend the line of a brother who doesn't have a child, which is very, I've met a couple people who are over in Africa. In Nigeria, that still happens. I know it happens in Liberia, it happens in Mozambique. which is Mozambique is an easier line to make than Nigeria in some ways. But I've known a half a dozen Christian pastors who have raised or given their sons, raised nephews or given sons to childless brothers in order to continue the line. Imagine that this is a real map. Pretty much everything that you read in the Old Testament, let's put this in here. Now you got it. Now it comes together. Happens in this area. There's supposed to be a boot over here somewhere. But the tradition is, and let me just say this, I'm not asking you to read this with me literally, I'm asking you to read it with me literarily and anthropologically. It's not about reading a literal reading, what they said is true, but their self-concept in the same way that you might read a story or a myth and understand something from that story or myth about how the people perceive themselves. So the story tells us that everything happened in this area or in this area over here. What we have a tendency to do, because the languages over here are closer to the languages over here, this is East Semitic, the Babylonian and Assyrian dialects, and Akkadian, the sort of the parent that gave us the writing system, are East Semitic. Hebrew, Aramaic is West Semitic Hebrew, Ugaritic, Phoenician, and with Phoenician is Punic, are Northwest Semitic languages, Arabic being a South Semitic language. So this is one family, a tighter family, and this is another family down here. But they're cousins. In the Nile up here, nobody will know exactly where we are. Now it's clearer for those of you who still want to see it. Trying to remember where I wanted to go with this, but it will come to me. Everything happens here until we get very late in the biblical period. There are some incursions about the 13th century. We get some people coming in off the sea and disrupting everything. Most people, as far as I know, still believe that these were the Philistines, were the sea peoples, line up with the sea peoples. Caused disruptions in Egypt, caused disruptions over here. The Hittites that came down, the real Hittites from Anatolia came down from here about the 21st century, but they are not the same Hittites that we hear about in David's time. Those are indigenous Semitic people, apparently, in this area.
Where did you say the Philistines came from?
They came in off the seas, and Nancy Sanders, N.K. Sanders, has written a nice book. It's nearly 30 years old now, called The Sea Peoples, and there have been things written about it since then. Nobody really knows where they came from.
Were they Vikings?
It's still a little early for the Vikings, but it has been seriously posited. I don't know if anybody still takes it seriously, that they were some of the lost Greeks coming back from the Trojan Wars. Oh. So that was what some people still believed in the 1980s when I was in grad school. I don't know if anybody still believes that. I haven't chased that piece down lately. There are more connections than most people give. The world was much more fluid than we usually give it credit for. There was more movement. And like I said, going back to the Neolithic period, you've got people coming from way up here all the way down into deep in the Nile Valley, and things from weird part, but you would normally think of as weird parts of Africa, coming up through the Nile Valley and ending up over in Mesopotamia and up in Anatolia. So So once the trade routes got established in the Neolithic period, these cultural exchanges continued right up until through Greek and Persian domination. Trying to decide which way to go first with this. So, what I'm working with is an idea that I don't know that I invented it, but I'm taking credit for it today. If somebody else read it someplace else, let me know before I write it down. we're pretty used now to talking about an Atlantic world. In the 1950s and moving forward until we started talking about the Atlantic world, we still talk about it in history and sociology and anthropology. Talked about the Mediterranean world. This is Brodel. Gilroy writes about the Black Atlantic now, but you go on the internet, you do a search, a Google search on Atlantic world. Harvard University does a symposium every year on the Atlantic world. I'm going to cite a paper from that sometime during this week that talks about the Spanish role in the idea of purity of blood. But from about, let's say from more or less 1500 to about 2000, the dominant trade power patterns in the world as we recognize it as Westerners was in the Atlantic world. The four poles being North America, South America, Europe, and Africa, with some participation by Asia. I think 2000 is too late. Let's say 1950. Since about 1950, especially Japan, and then in the 1970s, China and the rest of Asia really have changed the power balance. And I think that we need to start talking about, I don't know how to talk about it, if it's the Pacific Rim world, it's easier to talk about the Pacific Rim out here on the West Coast than it is in the Midwest, and the East Coast doesn't want to hear anything about it. Brodel talked about the power relationships coming out of the Roman Empire and how everything that was going on from about 800, 700 to about 1600, everything important from the European point of view happened in the Mediterranean world. North Africa, the Levant over here, and then southern and then later Northern Europe. I think from the late Neolithic period until the beginning of the Muslim Islamic conquest, we had an Afro-Asiatic world. The highest civilizations, for the most part, this is leaving out Asia, leaving out China, which had some incredible things going on that I don't control intellectually. So I, like everybody else, my universe is the center of the universe. I think this is where things were happening in terms of arts and science, literature, trade, and great powers. There were no great powers up here. There were few great powers in southern Africa, but there were some. There was not much going on in the Americas. So in terms of what we usually study in history, in anthropology, Afro-Asiatic was the place to be for several millennia. Just to go back to that, I jump back a little bit, talk about you all being Afro descendants and being able to do more dancing than you ever thought possible before. One of the current theories as to how we populated the earth was that about 80,000 before present, first surviving Homo sapiens sapiens left Africa out of Ethiopia, crossing over into Yemen, and took about 30, 35,000 years to populate the rest of the world. But the DNA, the mitochondrial DNA evidence and mapping with mitochondrial DNA indicates an exit here that then spread out to the rest of the world. For me, it explains some things, some mythological phenomena that are quite interesting. But this DNA stuff changes annually. But this is one of the current ideas. Where have I not been clear so far?
Why did you say that the Afroasiatic was the sort of major center until the Muslim? Why are you making a distinction there? Why is that not part of that whole period?
Well, it depends on how you think about the Muslim world. I have some problems with the way we usually present it in the West, the Islamic world. But one of the things that they did is that they centered themselves in Spain when they took over in Spain and what would later become Portugal. They brought science that was unthought of in Europe. They brought things to your science, music,
architecture
to Europe. Spain was the pearl of Europe, and that kind of shot things out and began to make this block here, this Mediterranean circle that, you know, with Turkey up here, still some things going on in the Levant and Northern Africa, coming out here in Northern Africa to Gibraltar. And then later they would develop in Europe as the retaking of Europe, and then the descent down into Africa would begin to develop the Atlantic world 7 or 8 centuries later. That's the only thing I was unclear about. It's amazing. Since the 18th century, we have known some things in the West. We have known some things in the West that are simply not true. The first among them would be that human races exist. For about 350 years, we have known that there are distinct human races. And we have known this because we needed to know it in order to support our Eurocentric view of the world. It happened, unfortunately, but not definitively, in Germany. This is the way I'm reading it. In Göttingen, at the end of the 18th century, there are two Johns, Johannes Blumenbach in the School of Medicine, and Johann David Michaelis, who taught Old Testament, Egyptology, and unfortunately, theology. Blumenbach, have you heard of him before? Blumenbach at the School of Medicine, he is known pretty much as the father of modern physical anthropology. If I'm not mistaken, he was a preacher's kid. I read about him a couple years ago, so I'm kind of fuzzy, but he was a devoutly religious man, and he was a strong monogenesis. That is to say, all human beings come from one stock. He published the translation is roughly the variation of human variations of human species. 3 editions, 1775. I'm not sure when the second edition came out, but 1795 was the third edition. In those intervening 20 years, with the nationalist battles that were going on and the need for a justification probably begs the question a little bit to say Aryan supremacy, but European Germanic supremacy. It's not just about the Africans and the Asians. It's also about the French and the English. You know, who exactly? Where are we in that pyramid of humankind? What gives us divine right? What gives us the right to say we're more cultured, we're more intelligent, we're more honest? Because all of these things, we don't do so much of it anymore today, unless you're playing sports. But all of the stuff that we, all of the ethical, moral characteristics that we associate with individuals today, in the 18th century, were associated with races. And Blumenbach, he held out for a few years not using the term race, or actually it was written in Latin, so the term gens or genus. He wrote first about varieties, and then finally in the third edition wrote about what was translated as races. And that's not so bad as far as I'm concerned, because if you're a physical scientist, all of your data, all of your conclusions are always subject to being overturned by the next discovery. Yeah? We knew some things 10 years ago about HIV that we don't know anymore because the new technology, the new research gave us a different idea. You know? 10 years ago, 15 years ago, you have HIV, you're going to die. Now there are people who are living comfortably with a series of medications. The death sentence has at least been postponed, if not abrogated. Problem is, Johann David Michaelis spoke the word of God. Michaelis, borrowing literally from Blumenbach, took his conclusions of the three in one edition, and then later five in the third edition, human races, and added to that the theological twist that somebody had to be the chosen race. Why not us? Ireland. Great things are happening at Göttingen. I make fun of them, but great things are. This is the guy who gave us modern physical anthropology. This is the guy who, even though I'm trashing him, sort of my methodological great-great-great-grandfather, because he is the father of social anthropological methodology applied to the study of the Old Testament. He is the guy who decided that when we study the Old Testament, we're going to go, when we look for cultural parallels to the Old Testament, we're going to go to Yemen, modern-day Yemen. That's where he sent his famous Carsten Niebuhr expedition, named for Carsten Niebuhr, not because he was the head of the expedition, but because he, as an assistant professor, was the only survivor of the expedition. Everybody else got cholera or malaria, and he was the only one who survived, so it was he who interpreted everything along with Michaelis. Running in parallel and not so parallel lines for a moment here. Michaelis was a rabid anti-Semite. One of the things that was being discussed in the late Enlightenment in Germany was what translates as the civic improvement of the Jews. Shorthand for, can the Jews really be integrated into German society? And Michaelis was publicly opposed to this. He said that even in 10 generations, the Jews could not be bettered, improved sufficiently to take a full place in the German society. In fact, there's a researcher from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, Jonathan Hess, who published a book last year, whose name escapes me, but it's 2000, Yale University Press, that sort of traces the career of Michaelis. And one of the things that he includes there is that Michaelis wanted to send the Jews to the Sugar Islands, to the Caribbean, to work in sugar production, so that they could make a where they could work with the other people of southern climes and make a financial contribution to the German economy where they could not make a contribution if they stayed. It never happened, but this is one of this gives a picture of who was teaching Old Testament at Göttingen in the 1860s and 70s. I'm convinced by reading around this guy that this is where, in the theological circles, we got into a real mess on the question of racism and racialization of the biblical text. Needing to take the text away from the Jews, whom he believed incompetent to read their own sacred literature. Only a Christian now could do that in the Christian era. Only a Christian could read the Old Testament properly through the lens of Christ. I think it's still the case that as a full professor of Old Testament, there has yet to be appointed a Jew in Germany. If somebody knows differently, I'm open to correction. But
So you're saying Michaelis in the 1850s and 70s.
Sorry, 1760s and 70s.
Oh, 1760s. Yeah. But weren't we doing, I mean, the conquistadors were, you know, well into South America by then, weren't they? And weren't they just like, you know, hey, this is all about, you know, Christianity, and I mean, a lot of stuff going on, and slavery was really starting to get going here and coming into the U.S. at that point. If certainly not into the southern, because there was a lie, no, in Puerto Rico, there was a big stopping over port in, the main town of Puerto Rico, main plane. Anyway, I mean, a lot of that was going on, and so what was the difference between, I mean, that seemed like it to be a big mess and pretty racist at that point, that we would hold dominion over these people and tell them, okay, not only the blacks from Africa, but natives of these islands. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are no more even indigenous Puerto Ricans because
they were wiped out.
Stuff, they were just wiped out. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. That was done on different religious grounds. And I will talk about that, but I hadn't planned to talk about it today. I mentioned this paper from the Harvard Symposium on the Atlantic World. Maria Elena Martinez has written quite eloquently about what happened in New Spain, Mexico, and I think the process is parallel in the rest of Iberian America. That old laws in the Spanish Inquisition were reopened in the case of the Americas to maintain power with a couple of families and within the church. This is sort of a hard week for Peter talking about the church and what it's done in its missionary endeavors. But
is that more a power struggle, you're saying?
I think it's all a power struggle. But the interesting thing for me with Blumenbach and Michaelis is that there's this interesting mixture of in Germany, in Göttingen in the 18th century, it ceases to become purely religious and becomes a scientific fact. Because a scientific fact, when Blumenbach finally gives up on his position under pressure from his colleagues to talk about all human beings as coming from one stock, when Michaelis picks it up in the theology school, and then it's not, once the professor of theology says it, it's no longer open to question in the same way as it is when the professor of medicine says it.
I think we're going full circle now, though. That it's being proven through DNA that we're coming from one stock.
Oh yeah, that's where I started this page is that, you know, 300 years ago we knew, or the past 300 years we have known that there are human distinct human races. But there are not. But this is something that we knew, we taught in the university, we taught in the church. The church picked it up and deified this, that God created these distinct human races, and some of them were made to serve us, the good guys, the best race. And that, unfortunately, pretty much doesn't matter which race you belong to, if you get a chance to dominate somebody, it's going to happen. It just happened more in the West with the white guys and white gals doing it. I saw a hand over here and the one over there.
How did the theologians get around the idea, the Old Testament idea that the Jews are the chosen race? I mean, how did they manage to substitute Germans for that?
How did we, that's a great question. How did we manage to do that in the United States?
Yeah.
We did exactly the same thing with the Deuteronomistic tradition of chosenness of the chosen people make a mistake, God chastises them, and there's a remnant. And somehow in the United States, the Puritans became that remnant. Somehow in Germany, where there was a serious problem all over Europe, that's not just with the Germans, actually there's a whole session that deals with Martinus and all these guys together. It's not just the Germans that are doing this. It's happening all over Europe. In part because it's so much more interesting than anybody ever taught me in school. Not that school is bad, but you know, they're just not time to do everything. For example, how interesting is the word slave? Has anybody ever stopped to think about how slave sounds like Slav? The word slave comes directly from Slav, which means the fame or the glory of people in Slavic languages. Why? Because in the 11th to the 12th century, the Jews who were iced out of Christian community were selling Slavs to the Muslims as slaves. Interesting stuff. My descendants are not Slavics. You know? They were slaves, but they're not Slavics. it's way more interesting than it gets painted, than there's time to paint it in almost anybody's picture. But there's also ideological teaching going on to maintain, to prop up certain parts of the heroic myth of any country. You know, the United States is not an exception there. It's just that it's my country, so I get to criticize it. Did you have a question on this? Do you have some help for me? Because I'm lost again.
Is this basically saying history is written by the winners? I mean, you're saying history is written by the winners. Is that the basic?
I'm saying that history has been written by the winners, but in this case, history, the church has a shameful collusion in the creation of a racialized world.
To support its version of history.
To support a Western church's version of history, in which, and my point as an Old Testament professor, is that what we have done is we've taken these stories and we've so Westernized them that we've made, as Tim pointed out, Jesus was a Jew. Right? But we don't, you know, my mother talks about David as a good Christian boy. Right? Well, you don't know my mom. And what I'm trying to get at eventually during this week is that the Jews thought of themselves as much more Afro-Asiatic, more African, at least five of the tribes, than we are willing to think about in the West.
Just a couple of comments. One is, you know, what was happening with race and ethnicity was also happening as people were taking the tradition of the monarchy, and that there were lords and there were serfs, and there was, you know, they didn't know what it was, but there was clearly a distinction between the classes and this whole tradition of blue blood and breeding. You know, that gentlemen and gentlewomen had good breeding, and so it was sort of shot through. You know, and so you get in the 1800s the whole idea that people could read the psychology of a person off their facial features and the bumps on their head, and that the physical bearing of a person, you know, clearly told you what they were made for in life.
Everybody, every woman who's wearing sandals or barefoot might want to cover up your feet right now. You might, I'm going to suggest Stephen Jay Gould's book, Mismeasure of Man. It's a great read. This phrenology, which we all laughed at when we saw it in the cartoons where somebody hits somebody in the head with a hammer and then they tell their future based on that. Well, guess what Blumenbach did to divide his races? He measured skulls. He had a collection of about 80 human skulls, and he measured them not simply for cranial capacity that would come later, but for their proportionality based on his idea of Aristotle's golden mean, which would be the most beautiful. Now, we think of Germans so often as, you know, cut and dried and mechanical. No, the Germans in the 18th century were all about poetry and beauty and emotion. So which is the most beautiful skull? Well, what a surprise. It's a Caucasian skull. Some of the things that Gould points out in that book that he wrote in the 80s, but revised in the 90s in response to the book The Bell Curve, which got so much publicity in the early 90s, that claimed to find the racial difference in intelligence among at least North Americans. Gould was so infuriated. Gould died last June, I think. Great loss. But he was so angered by the fact that this old, bad research from the 1940s and 50s came back again in the 90s and sold lots of books, that he redid a book that he had done 10 years earlier, specifically to chop this down, that this measuring that we constantly do among people and the constant attempts that among even the scientists to say, this is how we can predict, this is how we can know the look on your face, the way you hold your shoulders, the line of your nose tells me that you are a noble woman or a nobleman. Your IQ test tells me that you are a smart cookie. Well, your IQ test tells you that you could probably, because of your breeding in an upper middle class white American structure, not necessarily a white American person, but white American structure, you will probably do well in another white American structure. That's what an IQ test tells you. And Gould was adamant about this. As much as it pains me to cite another Harvard professor, Gould needs to be cited. biological fact that some races are better than others is a fact that we lived with for several centuries. And that these moral and ethical characters are racial characters. I mean, this is an idea that's not just new. I mean, the Greeks and the old classic logic question, how can you tell when a Greek or a Persian is lying or telling the truth? You know, he always lies, he always tells the truth, so when the response comes, how do you know that? You know, we did that, we've done that all along. But in this period, it becomes a part of our scientific knowledge and a part, in a strange way, of our religious knowledge. A second thing that's more important for me for this week is that the Israelites, what we knew for a long time is that the Israelites and the Egyptians were Caucasians.
They weren't.
I'm sorry to disappoint you.
But all the Bible pictures I've ever seen.
All the pictures in your Bible have a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus. Maybe a Moses with a really good tan.
He's out in the desert a lot.
Yeah, because he was out in the desert a lot. In the 1950s and 60s, the giants of Old Testament study said, okay, well, some of the Egyptians might have been Africans, but they were the slaves. And this is the great one, we measured their heads, we measured their skulls, and we know that the pharaohs, the leading classes, were Caucasians, and the slaves were the Negroes. Guess who wrote that? I'll bet you it's in the library here. This is in William Foxwell Albright's, he didn't say it exactly like that. He wasn't quite so sarcastic as I was. He was actually serious. In the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, Interpreter's Bible in 1956, in the article on the Old Testament world, or the world of the Old Testament. Even better, okay, the Ethiopians were kind of black. but only under the influence of their southern neighbors in the Sudan. This is Martine Nolte in 1962. Explain to me, all the maps gone, your perfect map is gone, how you can be in Africa. Well, this is another one of those ironies. In some cases, Ethiopians today immigrating to the United States, in the State Department jargon, are Caucasians. Mm-hmm. So, go figure. What does race mean? Right? It's not all that important to me, except for other people make it important, so I've got to respond. And that's why I'm talking about this stuff this year. So here's something for you to do when you go home. Go to the public library. If you're at a university or seminary, go to the seminary library. Take a look. See if Note, the Old Testament, World of the Old Testament, 1962, is still on the shelves. And if somebody has checked it out in the last 10 years, you know, run and tell that person to forget what they read. Or if the Interpreter's Bible is still on the shelf, I ask your librarian to burn it. And then go and look at the, there are lots of big coffee table books where you can just flip through the pages and look at the ancient Egyptian art. And if you look at these pictures and you're convinced that the Egyptians were Caucasians, please write me and tell me why I'm going blind. I look at the famous funerary mask of King Tut. The guy's got lips like mine and a nose like mine. Right? So he's got more gold. Okay. Yeah? But this is a brother. This is a brother. Yeah? Look at anything from the great Amarna workshop. And Tut's grandfather, Tut's grandmother, who is the beautiful Nefertiti. We all see Nefertiti from the Berlin Museum, where she's got that porcelain white skin and that aquiline nose and a big thing on her head. Looks like Erykah Badu. But look at Nefertiti from the Amarna workshop, which everyone agrees is naturalistic, that is really representational of what the people look like. It's an older Nefertiti. She's got a belly, her breasts are sagging, and she's a sister. She has a black face, Negroid features. Bright, Albright, Note, all these guys know these pictures. They've seen this stuff, and for some reason, nobody thinks to say, wait, this, we got to back off this idea. No one is left to think, say, we have to back off this idea. We have a Tim and I have a professor in common from Princeton Seminary who tried to teach me Coptic. I got some of it under my belt. And every year at the annual meeting of old biblical scholars and theological scholars, I run into him and he says, "Oh, Peter Dash, you were the only undergrad who took Coptic that year." So, yeah. That's all he remembers about me. What I remember about that course, aside from me struggling trying to learn Coptic, is that the introduction to this grammar, which was an old grammar already, goes to great lengths to point out that the Copts were not black Africans. I'm thinking, what is this doing in the grammar? You know, I want to learn the language. At that point, I really didn't care what color they were. So who gets to draw the lines and why we draw the lines the way we do becomes very important for me. Before I talked about this, any questions, any comments?
Yeah. Well, do you think the Ethiopians are labeled Caucasian because Solomon's relationship with the Queen of Sheba, and he wouldn't obviously relate to a person of African descent, so somehow she must have been Caucasian, or
it might be that goofy. I don't know why, and obviously in this past couple of years, nobody can understand the U.S. State Department. But in spite of the fact that there's a black man running it, so to speak, or so they say. Have you heard what George Carlin said about Colin Powell? God, no, I forgot what he said, but he's talking about how we use the term openly and happens to be. And we say that somebody happens to be black. Well, why is that a surprise? His parents are black. You know? if two Swedes had gone to bed and they had a black baby, then that would be something to say that. and then he talks about he's talking about minority language. He talks about somebody who's openly gay. It's the only time we say someone is openly anything is, you know, nobody's openly black. But if you're openly gay. And he says that, he goes on to say that he ends up somehow with Colin Powell. This is from back in the first Gulf War. He says Colin Powell is openly white. He just happens to be black. You can take that to George Carlin. I'm not sure why it happened that way. But in North Africa, one of the things that happened is that Northern Africa in general gets a different label from Sub-Saharan Africa. And until we started measuring people by their DNA, we thought we had good reason to do that. When we were labeling people phenotypically, that is, by how they look, then the Berbers and the Moors, this is one of those funny things, the Moors, the Moorish, the Moroccans, in many cases were not classified as black, but then why since Shakespearean times have they been referred to as black Moors?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's kind of playing with where we can make political alliances, where we're going to get what we want, and how I think we've played fast and loose with these racial categories for far too long, for far too many different political reasons, and that they've mixed in with the religious language. Just to return to the question about the New World, New Spain, what Martinez basically says is the concept of New Christian, which was imposed upon the converts from Islam and Judaism during the Inquisition, which required a three-generation, at least a three-generation, or until the memory of the Judaism or the Islam was erased from, as long as somebody in the group remembered that great-great-great-grandmother or great-great-great-grandfather was Muslim or Jew, then they still were new Christians and couldn't hold positions of confidence in the community. This was brought to the Americas maintain power in the appropriate Spanish families so that no Jew or Muslim would go over there and do the same thing. Then those categories were transferred to the Criollos, the American-born Spanish, children of Spaniards and Portuguese, so that the right families could maintain. And then to the mulattos y mulatas, the half-breeds and mixes, and then finally to the native peoples and the African slaves, and it splits there because of the native peoples, those were considered conversions, voluntary conversions, and then were eventually allowed to integrate into the Christian community, but at the last minute with the African slaves or the descendants of African slaves, since the conversions were forced, they never made a voluntary conversion, those conversions were suddenly no good. So it's an interesting and complex story of how that came through. Now, what's going on here? Somebody tell me what time is?
6:04.
Well, the question of how we read the Bible then, which is what I'm mostly all about, where we need interpretations that tell us, for example, that as a white person, I'm superior to her because she's a black person or an indigenous person. All this stuff that was going on in the 17th century got read right into the, right, especially with Michaelis and the School of Theology at Göttingen, which was a very influential school of theology in Germany, not only in Germany but throughout the world. That filters in. Let's just give one example, and then I'll let you go to supper. This didn't start back there, but I did a survey of the story of David, the story of Absalom's death being reported to David, which includes the story of a priest, son of a priest who wants to give the message, and what I interpret as a Cushite soldier in King David's army who is instructed to deliver the message. 1898, so what are we, 35 years after the Civil War, not quite 35 years after the Civil War, an Englishman writes, the Cushite, obviously a slave. Now, go home tonight if you want, read 2 Samuel 18, come back tomorrow if you want to, and tell me where in that story it says anything that indicates that this Cushite was a slave. The French, always more cultured than we English-speaking folk, said in 1911 and 1932, I think, Dorme and DeVoe wrote one copy and the other, of course. Or, excuse me, leaning on the research of the other. Joab sent a black messenger with the dark news. Isn't that nice? Herzberg, finally we get to blame a German, in 1965, or at least the English edition in 1965, wrote that because when the Cushite delivered the news, which the priest's son declined, he came to David with the news and said, we've won. And David says, my son. He says, your son, I don't know, you know? And then the Cushite comes and says, may all the king's enemies be as that young man. Takes a sort of a roundabout, gentle way to say your son is dead. Herzberg says, the guy wasn't thinking straight. He wasn't in full mental capacity when he delivered the news. Well, he was a soldier. You know, you're supposed to deliver the news, you deliver the news. You know, that's the way the army works, or is supposed to, unfortunately. Not until the 1980s did somebody say, what is this? You know, there are Cushites all over the place in Israel. There are Cushites all over the place in the ancient Near East, in all sorts of positions. There's no reason to understand any of them as slaves. This was Kyle McCarter in 1980-45 in the Anchor Bible Commentary. Some Dutch guy whose name I can never remember had also written that in the early 80s, but since McCarter's an American, we'll give him the credit. In 2000, Walter Brueggemann, who is no slouch in the Old Testament world, and a lot of other people are still writing things like, the Cushite, probably a slave. And what am I going to ask my students to read? How am I going to ask my students to read that stuff? So, time's up. Those who need to get going, I'm going to go eat with my family at 6:15, but we got about 5-10 minutes if there are questions for those who want to stay and ask questions afterwards. Thanks for your attention. Thank you.